I rejoice in your disposition to argue the Vietnam question, especially when I recognize what an act of self-control this must involve.
It does.
Sure.
It really does.
Sure.
I mean, I think that this is the kind of issue
you're
where...
Doing very well.
You know, sometimes I lose my temper. Maybe not
tonight. Maybe not tonight. because if you would, I'd smash you in the goddamn face. you say
it's
in
good
your
reason
book,
for not losing
you say the war is simply an obscenity, a depraved act by weak and miserable men.
Including all of us. Including myself.
Well,
including
then,
every... That's the next sentence. Same
yeah.
sentence.
Sure, oh, sure. Because you count everybody in the company of the guilty.
I think that's true in this case.
Yeah. But
see, one of the points I was
trying... This is a sense of theological observation, isn't it?
No, I don't think so.
Because the second point is, if everybody's guilty of everything, then nobody's guilty of anything.
No, I don't... Well, no, I don't believe that. See, yeah. I think the point that I'm trying to make, and I think ought to be made, is that the real... at least to me, I say this elsewhere in the book, a very, in a sense, terrifying aspect of our society and other societies is the equanimity and the detachment with which sane, reasonable, sensible people mm-hmm. can observe such events. I think that's more terrifying than the occasional Hitler or LeMay or other that crops up. These people would not be able to operate were it not for this apathy and equanimity. And therefore, I think that it's, in some sense, the sane and reasonable and tolerant people who should... who share a very serious burden of guilt that they very easily throw on the shoulders of others who seem more extreme and more violent.
12 million pounds of confetti dropped into New York City's so-called Canyon of Heroes. Americans were officially welcoming the troops home from the Persian Gulf War.
So it worked out really great for us. I mean, it just goes to show that we're a mighty nation and we'll be there. Or no matter what comes along, I mean, it's the strongest country in the world, and you got to be glad to live here.
So tell me what you feel about media coverage of the war.
I guess it was good. It got to be a bit much after a while, but I guess it was good to know everything, you know. I guess in Vietnam you didn't really know a lot was going on, but here you're pretty much up to the moment on everything, so I guess it was good to be informed.
For the first time, because of technology, we have the ability to be live from many locations around the globe. And because of the format, an all-news network, we can spend whatever time is necessary to bring the viewer the complete context of that day's portion of the story. And by context, I mean the institutional memory that is critical to understand why and how. And that's those who are analysts and do commentary, and those who can explain.
Slug that last piece, ITN, Israel post-war.
David Brinkley once said that you step in front of the camera and you get out of news business and into show business. But nonetheless, that should not in any way subtract or obscure the need for the basic standards of good journalism.
Pat, hang tight. Let me give you a lead for Salinger right now, okay? President Bush and Prime Minister Major have almost rejected the Soviet peace talk, peace efforts. Okay, in Saudi Arabia, the door is being left open. Rick Salinger is standing by live in Riyadh with the ladies.
All but closed.
Yeah, all but closed. Right.
Accuracy, speed, a fair approach, honesty and integrity within the reporter to try and bring the truth, whatever the truth may be.
Going to war is a serious business. In a totalitarian society, the dictator just says, we're going to war, and everybody marches.
And with this weapon of human brotherhood in our hands, we are seeing the war for men's minds, not as a battle of truth against lies, but as a lasting alliance pledged in faith with all those millions driving forward to create the true new order, the world order of the people first, the people before all.
In a democratic society, the theory is that if the political leadership has committed the war, they present reasons, and they got a very heavy burden of proof to meet, because a war is a very catastrophic affair, as this one proved to be. The role of the media at that point is to present the relevant background, for example, the possibilities of peaceful settlement, such as what they may be, have to be presented, and then to present, to offer a forum, in fact encourage a forum of debate over this very dread decision to go to war and in this case kill hundreds of thousands of people and leave two countries wrecked and so on. That never happened. There was never, well, you know, when I say never, I mean 99.9% of the discussion excluded the option of a peaceful settlement.
That Washington's Office of War Information calls one of the most vital and constructive tasks of this war.
This is a people's war, and to win it, the people ought to know as much about it as they can. This office will do its best to tell the truth and nothing but the truth, both at home and abroad.
First weapon in this worldwide strategy of truth is the great machine of information represented by the free press, with its powers of molding public thought and leading public action, with all its lifelines for the exchange of new ideas between fighting nations spread across the earth.
Every time George Bush would appear and say there will be no negotiations, there would be, you know, 100 editorials the next day lauding him for going the last mile for diplomacy. If he said you can't reward an aggressor, instead of cracking up in ridicule the way people did in civilized sectors of the world, like the whole third world, the media said, oh man, a fantastic principle, you know. The invader of Panama, the only head of state stands condemned for aggression in the world. The guy who was head of the CIA during the Timor aggression, you know, he says aggressors can't be rewarded. The media just applauded.
The motion picture industry, with its worldwide organization of newsreel camera crews, invaluable for bringing into vivid focus the background drama and perspectives of the war. Mobilized, too, in this all-out struggle for men's minds are the radio networks, with all their experience in the swift reporting of great occasion and event. From every strategic center and frontline stronghold, their reporters are sending back the lessons of new tactics, new ways of war.
The result was it's a media war. I mean, there's tremendous fakery all along the line. The UN is finally living up to its mission, you know, wondrous sea change, the New York Times told us. The only wondrous sea change was that for once the United States didn't veto a Security Council resolution against aggression. People don't want a war unless you have to have one, and they would have known that you don't have to have one. Well, the media kept people from knowing that, and that means we went to war very much in the manner of a totalitarian state, thanks to the media subservience. That's the big story. Now, remember, I'm not talking about a small radio station in Laramie. I'm talking about the national agenda-setting media. If you're on a radio news show in Laramie, chances are very strong that you pick up what was in the Times that morning and you decide that's the news. In fact, if you follow the AP wires, you find that in the afternoon, they send across tomorrow's front page of the New York Times. That's so that everybody knows what the news is. And the perceptions and the perspectives and so on are sort of transmitted down, and not to the precise detail, but the general picture is pretty much transmitted elsewhere.
The foreign news comes here to the foreign news desk. The editor is Bob Hanley. Bob, I suppose you get far more foreign news than you can possibly use in the paper.
Yes, we do. We get a great deal more than we can accommodate in a day.
And your job is to weed it out, I suppose.
This is the selection center, as it were. And when I have selected it, I pass it across the desk to one or the other of these sub-editors. It comes back to me, and on this chart, I design the page. That is page one and page two.
Fine, Bob. Thank you very much.
Why do you want to make a film about media?
Well,
such a nice, quiet town.
It's a beautiful town. Well, we're making a film about the mass media, so we thought, what a good place
to
come.
You want to know where they got the name.
So maybe you could start by introducing yourself.
Yes, I'm Bowden Senko. I'm the Main Street Manager and the Executive Director of the Media Business Authority. And we are in Media, Delaware County, in the southeastern part of Pennsylvania. Media is called everybody's hometown. The motto was developed as a way to promote the community. We're a very high promotion conscious community. When you walk through media, you'll be treated very well, and you find that people have taken the idea of being everybody's hometown to heart.
local paper, the Talk of the Town.
The Town Talk.
Do you read that?
Yes, I read the Town Talk, yes.
What do you think the difference is between the Wall Street Journal and the Talk?
Oh, well, I mean, the Town Talk is completely local news, and it's fun, it's nice to read, it's interesting. You read about your neighbors and see what's going on in the school district and things like that.
We're in business to make bucks, just like the big daily newspapers and just like the big radio stations, and we do quite well, and rightfully so, because we work very hard at it. I just want to show you a copy of the paper here, the way it is this week. It's plastic wrapped on all four sides, weatherproof, and hung on everybody's front door. And many times you'll find that this paper runs well over 100 pages a week. This particular edition, you have to remember there are 5 editions. This happens to be the Central Delaware County edition, which is the edition that covers Media, Pennsylvania. What you see here now is the Advertising and Composition Department. Say hello, guys, will you?
Hi.
Hi.
And what we're doing now is we're putting red dots, green dots, and yellow dots up on the map, wherever there is a store. Now, the red dots are the stores that don't advertise with us at all. The green dots are the ones that advertise with us every week, and the yellow dots are the ones that run sporadically.
If you have any special,
now we have computer printouts of every one of these stores, and what we do is we take the printouts of all the red dots, which are the bad guys, and what our idea is to turn these red dots into yellow dots, and turn the yellow dots into green dots, and eventually make them all green dots. So 100% of the stores and 100% of the merchants and the service people advertise in our newspaper every week. That way, we won't have any more red dots. I guess there'll always be a few red dots, but I have high hopes that there'll be a lot more green ones or red ones when we're finished.
Hi, I'm Jim Morgan. I'm with the Corporate Relations Department of the New York Times, and I'm here to take you on a tour of the New York Times, so let's begin. So, they're just taking audio in here. Yeah, they're taking audio in here. Audio. No cameras, no still. We went over this quite thoroughly. They don't even take a still camera in here. We're in the composing room. This is where the pages are composed. This is the typographical area.
What's the ratio of news to advertising?
60% ads. This might seem big, but it is average. In fact, below average. Our 60% might include, on some days, maybe 20 pages of classified advertising all to itself, where the rest of the newspapers weighted much heavier news to advertising. But the paper, in its entirety, every day, large or small, is 60 ads, 40 news. Well, that completes our tour of the New York Times, and I hope you found it informative, and I hope that you read the New York Times every day of your life from now on.
Now, there are other media, too, whose basic social role is quite different. It's diversion.
There's the real mass media, the kinds that are aimed at, you know, the guys who Joe Sixpack, that kind. The purpose of those media is just to dull people's brains.
This is an oversimplification, but for the 80% or whatever they are, the main thing for them is to divert them, to get them to watch National Football League and to worry about, you know, mother with child with six heads or whatever you pick up in the you know, in the thing that you pick up on the supermarket stands and so on, or you know, look at astrology or get involved in, you know, fundamentalist stuff or something, or just get them away, you know, get them away from things that matter, and for that it's important to reduce their capacity to think.
The sports section is handled in another special department. The sports reporter must be a specialist in his knowledge of sports. He gets his story right at the sporting event and often sends it into his paper play by play.
Take, say, sports. That's another crucial example of the indoctrination system, in my view. For one thing, because it, you know, it offers people something to pay attention to that's of no importance, that keeps them from worrying about, you know, keeps them from worrying about things that matter to their lives that they might have some idea about doing something about. And in fact, it's striking to see the intelligence that's used by ordinary people in sports. I mean, you listen to radio stations where people call in. They have the most exotic information and understanding about, you know, all kind of arcane issues. And the press undoubtedly does a lot with this. I remember in high school already, I was pretty old, I suddenly asked myself at one point,
why do I care if my high school team wins the football game? I mean, I don't know anybody on the team, you know. I mean, they have nothing to do with me. I mean, why am I cheering for my team? It doesn't mean it make any sense, you know. But the point is, it does make sense. It's a way of building up irrational attitudes of submission to authority and, you know, group cohesion behind, you know, leadership elements. In fact, it's training in irrational jingoism. That's also a feature of competitive sports. I think if you look closely at these things, I think they have, typically, they do have functions. And that's why energy is devoted to supporting them and creating a basis for them, and advertisers are willing to pay for them and so on.
I'd like to ask you a question essentially about the methodology in studying the propaganda model and how would one go about doing that.
Well, there are a number of ways to proceed. One obvious way is to try to find more or less paired examples. History doesn't offer true controlled experiments, but it often comes pretty close. So one can find atrocities or abuses of one sort that on the one hand are committed by official enemies and on the other hand are committed by friends and allies or by the favored state itself, by the United States in the U.S. case. And the question is whether the media accept the government framework or whether they use the same agenda, the same set of questions, the same criteria for dealing with the two cases as any honest outside observer would do.
If you think America's involvement in the war in Southeast Asia is over, think again.
The Khmer Rouge are the most genocidal people on the face of the earth.
Peter Jennings reporting from the killing fields, Thursday.
I mean, the great act of genocide in the modern period is Pol Pot, 1975 through 1978. That atrocity, I think it would be hard to find any example of a comparable outrage and outpouring of fury and so on and so forth. So that's one atrocity. Well, it just happens that in that case, history did set up a controlled experiment.
Have you ever heard of a place called East Timor?
Can't say that I have.
Where?
East Timor?
Nope.
No, huh?
Well, it happens that right at that time there's another atrocity, very similar in character, but differing in one respect. We were responsible for it, not Pol Pot.
Hello, I'm Louise Penny, and this is Radio Noon. If you've been listening to the program fairly regularly over the last few months, you'll know East Timor has come into the conversation more than once, particularly when we were talking about foreign aid and also the war and a new world order. People wondered why, if the UN was serious about a new world order, no one was doing anything to help East Timor. The area was invaded by Indonesia in 1975. There are reports of atrocities against the Timorese people. And yet Canada and other nations have consistently voted against UN resolutions to end the occupation. Today we're going to take a closer look at East Timor, what's happened to it, and why the international community is doing nothing to help. One of the people who have been most active is Elaine Bruyere, a photojournalist from British Columbia. She's the founder of the East Timor Alert Network, and she joins me in studio now. Hello.
Hi.
Tragedy compounding a tragedy is that a lot of people don't know much about East Timor. Where is it?
East Timor is just north of Australia, about 420 kilometers, and it's right between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. Just south of East Timor is a deep water sea lane, perfect for U.S. submarines to pass through. There's also huge oil reserves there. One of the unique things about East Timor is that it's truly one of the last surviving ancient civilizations in that part of the world. The Timorese spoke 30 different languages and dialects amongst a group of 700,000 people. Today, less than 5% of the world's people live like the East Timorese. Basically self-reliant, they live really outside of the global economic system. Small societies like the East Timorese are much more democratic and much more egalitarian, and there's much more sharing of power and wealth. Before the Indonesians invaded, most people lived in small rural villages. The old people in the village were like the university. They passed on tribal wisdom from generation to generation. children grew up in a safe, stimulating, nurturing environment. A year after I left East Timor, I was appalled when I heard that Indonesia had invaded. They didn't want a small, independent country setting an example for the region.
East Timor was a Portuguese colony. Indonesia had no claim to it, and in fact stated that they had no claim to it. During the period of colonization, there was a good deal of politicization that different groups developed. A civil war broke out in August 75. It ended up in a victory for Fretilin, which was one of the groupings, described as populist Catholic in character with some typical leftish rhetoric. Indonesia at once started intervening.
What's the situation? When did those ships come in?
They started arriving since Monday. Six, seven boats together, very close to our border. No, they're not there just for fun, you know. They're preparing a massive operation.
Something happened here last night that moved us very deeply. It was so far outside our experience as Australians that we'll find it very difficult to convey to you, but we'll try. Sitting on woven mats under a thatched roof in a hut with no walls, we were the target of a barrage of questioning from men who know they may die tomorrow and cannot understand why the rest of the world does not care. That's all they want, for the United Nations to care about what is happening here. The emotion here last night was so strong that we, all three of us, felt we should be able to reach out into the warm night air and touch it. Greg Shackleton at an unnamed village, which we'll remember forever, in Portuguese Timor.
Ford and Kissinger visited Jakarta, I think it was December 5th. We know that they had requested that Indonesia delay the invasion until after they left because it would be too embarrassing. And within hours, I think, after they left, the invasion took place on December 7th.
What happened on December 7th in 1975 is just one of the great, great evil deeds of history. Early in the morning, bombs began dropping on Dili. The number of troops that invaded Dili that day almost outnumbered the entire population of the town. And for 2 or 3 weeks, there was just, they just killed people.
E quando eu vi dizer fogo, eu gritei-me logo, pus-me logo no chão. Pus-me no chão, e só senti os corpos a caírem por cima de mim, pareciam folhas, né, a caírem por cima de mim. E acompanhado de gritos, outros a chamarem pela mãe, a esposa, né. Aquilo era mesmo terrível.
This council must consider Indonesia's aggression against East Timor as the main issue of the discussion.
When the Indonesians invaded, the UN reacted as it always does, calling for sanctions and condemnation and so on. Various watered-down resolutions were passed, but the US was very clearly not going to allow anything to work.
So the Timorese were fleeing into the jungles by the thousands. By late 1977-78, Indonesia set up receiving centers for those Timorese who came out of the jungle waving white flags. Those the Indonesians thought were more educated or who were suspected of belonging to Fretilin or other opposition parties were immediately killed. They took women aside and flew them off to Dili in helicopters for use by the Indonesian soldiers. They killed children and babies. But in those days, their main strategy and their main weapon was starvation.
By 1978, it was approaching really genocidal levels. the church and other sources estimated about 200,000 people killed. The U.S. backed it all the way. The U.S. provided 90% of the arms. Right after the invasion, arms shipments were stepped up. When the Indonesians actually began to run out of arms in 1978, the Carter administration moved in and increased arms sales. And other Western countries did the same. Canada, England, Holland, and everybody who could make a buck was in there trying to make sure they could kill more Timorese. There is no Western concern for issues of aggression, atrocities, human rights abuses, and so on, if there's a profit to be made from them. Nothing could show it more clearly than this case. It wasn't that nobody had ever heard of East Timor. Crucial to remember that there was plenty of coverage in the New York Times and elsewhere before the invasion. The reason was that there was concern at the time over the breakup of the Portuguese Empire and what that would mean. There was a fear that it would lead to independence or Russian influence or whatever. After the Indonesians invaded, the coverage dropped. There was some, but it was strictly from the point of view of the State Department and Indonesian generals, never a Timorese refugee. As the atrocities reached their maximum peak in 1978, when it really was becoming genocidal, coverage dropped to zero in the United States and Canada, the two countries have looked at closely, literally dropped to zero. All this was going on at exactly the same time as the great protest of outrage over Cambodia. The level of atrocities was comparable. In relative terms, it was probably considerably higher in Timor. It turns out right in Cambodia in the preceding years, 1970 through 1975, there was also a comparable atrocity for which we were responsible. The major U.S. attack against Cambodia started with the bombings of the early 1970s. They reached a peak in 1973, and they continued up till 1975. They were directed against inner Cambodia. Very little is known about them because the media wanted it to be secret. They knew what was going on, they just didn't want to know what was happening. The CIA estimates about 600,000 killed during that five-year period, which is mostly either U.S. bombing or a U.S.-sponsored war. So that's pretty significant killing. But also the conditions in which it left Cambodia were such that high U.S. officials predicted that about 1 million people would die in the aftermath, just from hunger and disease because of the wreckage of the country. Pretty good evidence from U.S. government sources and scholarly sources that the intense bombardment was a significant force, maybe a critical force, in building up peasant support for the Khmer Rouge, who before that were a pretty marginal element. Well, that's just the wrong story. After 1975, atrocities continued, and that became the right story, because now they're being carried out by the bad guys. Well, it was bad enough. In fact, current estimates are that, well, you know, they vary. I mean, the CIA claim 50 to 100,000 people killed and maybe another million or so who died one way or another. Michael Vickery is the one person who's given a really close, detailed analysis. His figure is maybe 750,000 deaths above the normal. Others, like Ben Kiernan, suggest higher figures, but so far without a detailed analysis. Anyway, it was terrible. No doubt about it. Although the atrocities, the real atrocities, were bad enough, they weren't quite good enough for the purposes needed. Within a few weeks after the Khmer Rouge takeover, the New York Times was already accusing them of genocide. At that point, maybe a couple hundred or maybe a few thousand people had been killed. And from then on, it was a drumbeat, a chorus of genocide. Big bestseller on Cambodia, Pol Pot, is called Murder in a Gentle Land. Up until April 17, 1975, it was a gentle land of peaceful, smiling people, and after that, some horrible Holocaust took place. Very quickly, a figure of 2 million killed was hit upon. In fact, what was claimed was that the Khmer Rouge boast of having murdered 2 million people. Facts are very dramatic. In the case of atrocities committed by the official enemy, extraordinary show of outrage, exaggeration, no evidence required, faked photographs are fine, anything goes. Also, vast amount of lying.
I mean, an amount of lying that would have made Stalin cringe. It was fraudulent, and we know that it was fraudulent by looking at the response to comparable atrocities for which the United States was responsible. Early 70s Cambodia, Timor, two very closely paired examples. Well, the media response was quite dramatic.
Back in 1980, I taught a course at Tufts University. Well, Chomsky came around to this class. He made a very powerful case that the press underplayed the fact that the Indonesian government annexed this former Portuguese colony in 1975. And that if you compare it, for example, with Cambodia, where there was acreage of things, that this was a communist atrocity, whereas the other was a communist atrocity. Well, I got quite interested in this, and I went to talk to the then deputy foreign editor of the Times, and I said, you know, we've had very poor coverage on this, and he said, you're absolutely right. There are a dozen atrocities around the world that we don't cover. This is one for various reasons. So I took it up.
I was working as a reporter and writer for a small alternative radio program in upstate New York, and we received audio tapes of interviews with Timorese leaders. And we were quite surprised that given the level of American involvement, that there was not more coverage, indeed practically any coverage, of the large-scale Indonesian killing in the mainstream American media. We formed a small group of people to try to monitor the situation and see what we could do over time to alert public opinion to what was actually happening in East Timor.
There were literally about half a dozen people who simply dedicated themselves with great commitment to getting the story to break through. And they reached a couple of people in Congress. They got to me, for example. I was able to testify at the UN and write some things. They kept at it, kept at it, kept at it. Whatever is known about the subject is mainly comes from their work. There's not much else.
I wrote first an editorial called An Unjust War in East Timor. It had a map, and it said exactly what had happened. We then ran a dozen other editorials on it. They were read, they were entered in the congressional record, and several congressmen then took up the cause, and then something was done in Congress as a result of it.
The fact that the editorial page in the New York Times on Christmas Eve published that editorial put our work on a very different level. And it gave a great deal of legitimacy to something that we were trying to advance for a long time, and that was the idea and the reality that a major tragedy was unfolding in East Timor.
If one takes literally the various theories that Professor Chomsky puts out, one would feel that there is a tacit conspiracy between the establishment press and the government in Washington to focus on certain things and ignore certain things, so that if we broke the rules, that we would instantly get a reaction, a sharp reaction from the overlords in Washington, who would say, hey, what are you doing speaking up on East Timor? We're trying to keep that quiet. We didn't hear a thing. What we did hear, and this was quite interesting, is that there was a guy named Arnold Cohn, and he became a one-person lobby.
I appreciate the nice things that Karl Meyer said about me in his interview, but I object to the notion that a one-man lobby was formed or anything like that. I think that if there weren't a large network composed of the American Catholic Bishops Conference, composed of other church groups, composed of human rights groups, composed of simply concerned citizens and others, and a network of concern within the news media, I think that it would have been impossible to do anything at all at any time, and it certainly would have been impossible to sustain things for as long as they've been sustained.
Professor Chomsky and a lot of people who engage in this kind of press analysis have one thing in common. Most of them have never worked for a newspaper. Many of them know very little about how newspapers work.
Dr. Davis, telephone.
When Chomsky came around, he had with him a file
of all the coverage in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other papers of East Timor. And he would go to the meticulous degree that if, for example, the London Times had a piece on East Timor, and then it appeared in the New York Times, that if a paragraph was cut out, he'd compare and he'd say, look, this key paragraph, right near the end, which is really what tells the whole story, was left out of the New York Times version of the London Times thing.
There was a story in the London Times, which is pretty accurate. The New York Times revised it radically. Didn't just leave a paragraph out. They revised it and gave it a totally different cast. It was then picked up by Newsweek, giving it the New York Times cast. It ended up being a whitewash, whereas the original was an atrocity story.
So I said to Chomsky at the time, I said, well, it may be that you're misinterpreting ignorance, haste, deadline pressure, etc., for some kind of determined effort to suppress an element of the story.
He said, well, if it happened once or twice or three times, I might agree with you, but if it happens a dozen times, Mr. Meyer, I think there's something else at work.
And it's not a matter of happening one time, two times, five times, 100 times, it happened all the time.
I said, Professor Chomsky, having been in this business, it happens a dozen times, these are very imperfect institutions.
When they did give coverage, it was from the point of view of, it was a whitewash of the United States. Now, you know, that's not an error. That's systematic, consistent behavior, in this case, without even any exception.
This is a much more subtle process than you get in the kind of the sledgehammer rhetoric of the people that make an A to B equation between what the government does, what people think, and what newspapers say. That sometimes what the Times does can make an enormous difference. At other times, it has no influence whatsoever.
So one of the greatest tragedies of our age is still happening in East Timor. The Indonesians have killed up to a third of the population. They're in concentration camps. They conduct large-scale military campaigns against the people who are resisting. Campaigns with names like Operation Eradicate or Operation Clean Sweep. Timorese women are subjected to a forced birth control program. In addition, they're bringing in a constant stream of Indonesian settlers to take over the land. Whenever people are brave enough to take to the streets in demonstrations or show the least sign of resistance, they just massacre them. It's sort of like Indonesia. If we allow them to continue to stay in East Timor, the international community, they will simply digest East Timor and turn it into, trying to turn it into cash crop.
I mean, this is way beyond just demonstrating the subservience of the media to power. I mean, they have real complicity in genocide in this case. The reason that the atrocities can go on is because nobody knows about them. If anyone knew about them, there'd be protests and pressure to stop them. So therefore, by suppressing the facts, the media are making a major contribution to some of the, probably the worst act of genocide since the Holocaust.
You say that what the media do is to ignore certain kinds of atrocities that are committed by us and our friends, mm-hmm. and to play up enormously atrocities that are committed by them and our enemies. And you posit that there's a test of integrity and moral honesty, which is to have a kind of equality of treatment of corpses.
Equality of principles.
That every dead person should be in principle equal to every other dead person.
That's not what I say at all.
Well, I'm glad that's not what you say, because in fact, that's not what you do.
Of course it's not what I do. Nor would I say it. I say the opposite. What I say is that we should be responsible for our own actions primarily.
Because your method is not only to ignore the corpses created by them, but also to ignore the corpses that are created by neither side, but which are irrelevant to your ideological
agenda. That's totally untrue.
Well, let me give you an example. Okay. One of your own causes that you take very seriously is the cause of the Palestinians. And a Palestinian corpse weighs very heavily on your conscience. And yet a Kurdish corpse does not.
That's not true at all. I've been involved in Kurdish support groups for years.
That's absolutely true. It's absolutely false. I mean, just ask the Kurdish, ask the people who are involved in, I mean, you know, they come to me, I sign their petitions and so on and so forth. And in fact, if you look at the things we've written, I mean, let's take a look. I mean, I'm not Amnesty International. I can't do everything. I'm a single person. But if you read, say, take a look, say, at the book that Edward Herman and I wrote on this topic. In it, we discuss three kinds of atrocities. What we called benign bloodbaths, which nobody cares about, constructive bloodbaths, which are the ones we like, and nefarious bloodbaths, which are the ones that the bad guys do. The principle that I think we ought to follow is not the one that you stated. You know, it's a very simple ethical point. You're responsible for the predictable consequences of your actions. You're not responsible for the predictable consequences of somebody else's actions. The most important thing for me and for you is to think about the consequences of your actions. What can you affect?
These are the things to keep in mind. These are not just academic exercises. We're not analyzing the media on Mars or in the 18th century or something like that. We're dealing with real human beings who are suffering and dying and being tortured and starving because of policies that we are involved in. We, as citizens of democratic societies, are directly involved in and are responsible for. And what the media are doing is ensuring that we act on our responsibilities and that the interests of power are served, not the needs of the suffering people and not even the needs of the American people, who would be horrified if they realized the blood that's dripping from their hands because of the way they're allowing themselves to be deluded and manipulated by the system. What about the third world? Well, despite everything, and it's pretty ugly and awful, these struggles are not over. The struggle for freedom and independence never is completely over. Their courage, in fact, is really remarkable and amazing. I've personally had the privilege, and it is a privilege, of witnessing it a few times in villages in Southeast Asia and Central America, and recently in the occupied West Bank, and it is astonishing to see.
And it's always amazing, at least to me it's amazing, I can't understand it. It's also very moving and very inspiring. In fact, it's kind of awe-inspiring. Now, they rely very crucially on a very slim margin for survival that's provided by dissidence and turbulence within the imperial societies. And how large that margin is for us to determine.